Blog Talk Radio.
Why does sickle cell affect so many black people? And what are the chances of someone in your family carrying the sickle cell trait? We'll talk with Reverend Ronald Stevenson, the president and founder of the Greater Boston Sickle Cell Disease Association, and learn more about the upcoming February 26th Day of Prayer. Then we'll learn more about the various voter restriction laws passed between 2010 and 2011 and directly affecting African-American voters across the country. Many of these laws will have a major impact on the 2012 presidential election. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Hello, my friends. I'm so glad you joined us today. I'm out and about here in Boston and hope that you are doing your thing and hope that the weather is holding up wherever you happen to be. We're so glad that you're listening to the show. This is Carol Copeland Thomas. I'm still getting lots of wonderful accolades and praise reports from the February 2nd Black History Breakfast. We kicked off Black History Month with a real big bang, having that wonderful event with Juanita Jones Abernathy as our keynote speaker. Again, a special thanks to our sponsors, our volunteers, all those participants who came, those who heard about the event and wanted to be supportive. We are just very, very grateful. We're getting ready to update our website, putting more information about the breakfast and pictures. There will be a video that we're developing, and that will be made available in the coming weeks. Our webinar series is also kicking off, and you'll find out more about that. So I'm excited about Black History Month and excited about all the things that are taking place with C. Thomas & Associates and the Multicultural Symposium Series. You can go to both websites and find out more details, either at tellcarol.com, that's www.tellcarol.com, or www.mssconnect.com. Thank you so much for all that you continue to do to advance multiculturalism and global diversity and empowerment wherever you happen to be. Well, we're going to turn our attention to a very pressing disease that I've known about for many years that gets talked about certain corners of our society, and then others don't really know that much about it. And it's called sickle cell. We used to call it sickle cell anemia, but now it's called sickle cell disease. And I'm bringing on a very compassionate leader who actually has done something for those who suffer from sickle cell disease. He is the founder and president of the Greater Boston Sickle Cell Disease Association, Reverend Ronald Stevenson. Welcome to the program, Reverend Stevenson.
Thank you so much, Carol. I want to thank you for inviting me to the program today and for allowing me to share with your listeners.
Absolutely. Tell us, first of all, what is sickle cell disease?
Well, the first thing I must say about sickle cell disease is that it's not contagious as a lot of people think. Sickle cell disease is actually an inherited blood disorder caused by an abnormality in the red blood cell. You see, the red blood cell is responsible for carrying oxygen to all parts of the body. And when a person has sickle cell disease, some of their red blood cells are abnormal. They take on a sickled or a crescent shape. The problem is that when the cells become sickled, it creates a buildup in the body or in the blood vessels. These blood vessels become, clogged, and therefore it leads to acute pain crises and eventually tissue and organ damage. In the United States, I just want to share with your listeners that sickle cell disease is found mostly amongst African Americans and other people of African descent. There is no cure for sickle cell disease. I would like them to know also.
What do you have any evidence, or I know that we have information, and you have information that you've sent me from the CDC, and why people of color, why people from the African diaspora, sub-Saharan Africa, any reason, any connection with that, Reverend Stevenson?
Yes, well, people from the that particular region in Africa, the sub-Saharan region, were highly exposed to malaria, and sickle cell was actually the body's building up this immune system to malaria. And because malaria is now so controlled, this sickle cell now has an adverse effect on those who carry, you know, the trait.
Mm-hmm.
So sickle cell was a positive thing at one time because it you know, inhibit people from becoming...
contracting malaria.
Right, from contracting malaria.
Uh-huh.
But
boy, never knew that connection.
What was positive is now a negative.
Interesting. And I also see here the common among ancestors who come from sub-Saharan Africa, regions in the Western Hemisphere, South America, the Caribbean, Central America, Saudi Arabia, India, and the Mediterranean countries, Turkey, Greece, and Italy, all very
right.
warm climate countries. So I
yeah.
see the connection between malaria and obviously sickle cell. So, you know, here in the United States, it continues to be a large problem. How many, approximately how many African Americans are in some way touched by this disease?
Yeah, in terms of African American population, the rate of trait amongst African Americans is 1 in 12. 1 in 12 African American carry the sickle cell trait, and in terms of disease, it's 1 in 400 would come down with the disease.
I see.
I must say that sickle cell has also surfaced in other groups. You know, they are. To give you an example, we have a family in Western Massachusetts, an Irish family, where this child has sickle cell disease. So you
wow.
cannot now only identify it by the color of a person's skin. As you know, there have been a lot of, you know, interracial marriage and relationships that are
right.
producing offspring. And so the gene is you'd say, invading a number of various
other
cultures and ethnic groups, yeah.
Interesting. And tell us your personal connection for starting the Greater Boston Sickle Cell Disease Association, Reverend Stevenson.
Yeah, well, while I was a seminary student at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, I worked part-time at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and got introduced to a young lady who had sickle cell disease, and she had journaled her life story with living with this disease, and it was from her that I learned about sickle cell. And what really got me involved is this young lady said, you know, what is more painful to me about sickle cell is not the pain crises that I go through, and of course they're excruciating, but it's the fact that no one seems to care. And
wow.
she wanted
wow.
an avenue to tell her story, and I made a pledge that day to create an organization that would give her an opportunity to share a story with others.
And now you have a staff and reach out to the Greater Boston community. I've seen your advisory board with all the medical professionals. So what was an idea and a place for you to help certainly has become probably a lifeline for those who suffer from this incurable disease. Can you tell us about the day of prayer that's coming up on February 26th?
Yes, well, just before I mention that, faith has always been significant, you know, especially amongst African Americans, as you know, where faith has been a part of us. And prior to the medical breakthroughs and treatment of sickle cell disease, a lot of people who had it back then, just think back to slavery, they relied on faith. They relied on prayer to see them through. I think their faith brought them through. And as a pastor, as a believer, I believe that if we turn to God in prayer, the cure for sickle cell can be expedited, or God can perform a miracle in bringing about this cure for sickle cell disease in a shorter time than we are anticipating.
And so with that faith background and your training as a theologian, and you're getting together with thousands of other faith-based communities to pray in one accord for patients and families affected by sickle cell. Give us more information about this day of prayer, Reverend Stevenson.
Yes, that is so true, Carol. We have sent out letters or invitations to over 1,000 churches in the greater Boston region to join us on Sunday, February 26th for a prayer for sickle cell disease. All we're asking is that the church or the pastors, during their time of intercessory prayer, to remember those who are suffering with sickle cell disease, to pray for a cure for sickle cell, and to pray God's grace and mercy in the lives of those who are suffering. It's a debilitating type of illness. People are suffering. It affects the entire family. It affects community. And we need a breakthrough in the area of sickle cell. So that's what the prayer is all about.
Well, this is certainly a wonderful way to express compassion and support for those who are suffering. The young woman, the young lady who you met at Brigham and Women's Hospital, do you keep in touch with her? Is she an active part of the association?
Well, sadly to say, she was a part of it, but sadly to say, this young lady would travel around New England with me talking about sickle cell. And it so happened that we met a producer, and he's now a TV anchor person, now working at a television station where I just left an interview about the prayer. But through that TV anchor person, this young lady had a documentary done about her life, living in sickle cell disease. And I say this to say, after the documentary was aired, which was maybe about 8 years ago, sadly, she passed away months afterwards. But her dream was fulfilled.
And her, certainly living through you. Yes, and living through you, and you certainly have done an awful lot to help spread that. For those who are interested in more information, please visit the website for Greater Boston Sickle Cell Disease Association, and that's www.gbscdaassociation.org. www.gbscda.org. And for more information, call them about the Day of Prayer that's taking place on Sunday, February 26th at 617-427-4100. 617-427-4100. In closing, Reverend Stevenson, do you have words of encouragement for those who are struggling with this disease or have relatives who are living with the disease?
Yes, what I've discovered is that having hope can take a person through no matter what crisis you have in life. And so I want to say to those who have the disease to remain hopeful. There are some great things taking place in this in the sickle cell treatment and care, and there's a lot to hope for and live for. And so I just want to encourage those with the disease to let them know, yes, people do care, and if you have hope and faith and belief in God, you can make it. You can make
wonderful
it.
Wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful parting words, too. I want to thank you, Reverend Ronald Stevenson, the founder, the visionary founder and president of the Greater Boston Sickle Cell Disease Association. They are asking faith-based organizations everywhere to participate with their Day of Prayer on Sunday, February 26, 2012, to pray for all the families and all those who are affected by sickle cell disease. Reverend Stevenson, thank you so much for being a guest on my program.
Thank you, Carol, and thanks for having me here.
All right, thanks so much. God bless. Take care. Well, again, we've been talking with Reverend Ronald Stevenson, who is the president and founder of the Greater Boston Sickle Cell Disease Association. What a man of faith he is, and certainly hope is so, so important. We wish all those who suffer from this disease. I have known several people who have had this disease, and there is no cure for it, and we just hope them an opportunity to live a brighter life, a life of hope and future. And the day of prayer is certainly going to be an opportunity for all of us to get involved in that. So, again, hats off to Reverend Stevenson and the Greater Boston Sickle Cell Disease Association. We're going to turn our attention now back to something that I think is just really important for us to discuss and talk about. It's sort of a carryover from our discussion last week when I was in Washington, D.C. For Delta Days at the nation's capital, and we discussed many bills and bills that had come before Congress, our House of Representatives, and the Senate. But one of them that just is so important that affects everybody, but I'm sort of targeting my remarks now to the African-American community because it is Black History Month, and those are the various legislative initiatives that are in place currently that are they're actually related to voter suppression, putting restrictions on voting that will in part require people to do certain things before they are eligible to vote. And we're specifically talking about the primary and the general elections across the country, and particularly the African-American community. It's expected that the presidential general election that will take place in November of 2012 is going to be a tight election. We don't know who the Republican candidate is going to be. We do know that President Barack Obama will be the Democratic candidate running for re-election for another four-year term. And we'll see what's going to happen over the next couple of months with the Republican primaries that continue to take place. But needless to say, a lot of the pollsters, a lot of the polls that are showing, we know that the polls go back and forth, but it's going to be a very tight race. It may swing 5 points, maybe 10 points. I don't think it's going to be a 10-point spread. I think it's going to be more like a 5-point spread. And with that said, it means that every vote is going to count in this upcoming election, every single vote. I'll read you the list again, and I'll go a little bit more in detail about what this actually means. There are a number of key states who, between 2010 and 2011, put measures on their state ballots that required some kind of documentation for people to vote. Now, it's controversial in terms of whether this makes sense or whether it doesn't make sense, but I'll make my point in just a few minutes. When it comes to restrictions on third-party registration, that includes the states of Florida and Texas. When it comes to restrictions on when and where people can register to vote, again, people move around, they go from one ward to another ward, one precinct to another precinct, and timing is everything when it comes to being registered for primaries and going into the general election. We're looking at four states where these restrictions have had impact on people, and that's Florida, Maine, Ohio, and Wisconsin. Now, I think one of the most controversial measures are these documentation where proof of citizenship is required. And some of the most stringent measures have been passed in the state of Alabama, in Kansas, and in Tennessee. Now, again, if you're born in this country, it's not a problem. But if you are in the process of becoming a citizen, or if you're in the process, let's say you are a citizen in this country, you have to be a citizen in order to vote. And let's say for whatever reason you have misplaced your citizen papers or whatever, there may be some individuals who will become a little nervous and won't want to go to the polls for fear that it may unearth some other family members who are not documented, who are undocumented. I'm just sort of making this up. But in the states of Alabama, Kansas, and Tennessee, you have to prove your citizenship. I have my birth certificate in my wallet. It's a small wallet size, but there are some people in the United States where they were born at home with a midwife, and they don't have a birth certificate, or they've never gotten a birth certificate. The midwife wrote all the information in the family Bible, and that served as proof of that person actually being born. So that's an example, and there's actually a woman in Tennessee who is in her 80s who has been voting for decades, an African-American who's been voting for decades, and she's in that predicament. She was born via a midwife, and she does not have a birth certificate, so it creates a dilemma in that case. Now, in the state of Wisconsin, there is duration residency requirements. In other words, in some states, there's you have to live in a particular state for a period of time. This will impact mostly students who, let's say, are going to the University of Wisconsin or one of the other universities there, and they're from out of state. And last year, the previous year, or maybe 3 or 4 years ago, they voted in Wisconsin, and they want to continue to vote there. But they go back home in the summertime, or they go elsewhere, and they don't live in Wisconsin full-time. Well, based on their residency requirements, it can be negatively impactful on those who are in that predicament. In the state of Florida and Iowa, there are measures in place where enhanced ex-offender disenfranchised laws have taken effect. I know this has been a case in, we've been talking about that here in Massachusetts, in New York, and other states. But again, based on the crime that you've done and you've paid your time, there are enhanced measures to make sure you don't vote in the upcoming elections. There are enhanced restrictions on early or absentee ballots in the following five states: Florida, Georgia, Maine, Tennessee, and West Virginia. Again, same kind of scenario. Someone, let's say, goes out of town maybe a few days before the elections take place. And again, based on these restrictions, it may or may not affect or impact their absentee opportunities, their opportunities to vote absentee ballot. And then the last one, again, very controversial, where they are requiring a photo ID, requiring a photo ID to register to vote. I go back to the same Tennessee woman who, you know, may have been born via a midwife, not in a hotel, not in a hospital. Maybe she stopped driving 30 years ago or 25 years ago, and she's not driving. That can be an issue as well. So for the states of Alabama, Kansas, Mississippi, Rhode Island, which I had a discussion with earlier in the week with a group of civically engaged women, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Wisconsin, these are the states that have these photo ID requirements in order for you to vote. Now, there is a measure. The problem with discrimination and where it is rearing its ugly head is in the black community and in communities, younger populations as well. Case in point, I'm getting this information from the NAACP. You can go right to the NAACP, that's NAACP.org, NAACP.org, download their action alerts as it relates to voting. And they have information here that photo ID requirements, as we see them at the federal, state, and local level, are creating a barrier to keep the up to 21 million Americans, or 11% of the entire voter eligibility populations who do not have government-issued photo IDs out of the ballot booth. So again, when they're talking about photo IDs, they're talking about a government-issued one. And again, for some people, it may seem like a no-brainer for some, but no, it could be quite difficult for others. And sadly, a disproportionate number of people who do not have government-issued IDs are racial and ethnic minorities, the elderly, and low-income Americans. A full 25% of African Americans who would otherwise be eligible to vote do not have a qualified ID. And according to one study, state photo IDs and other efforts to suppress voter rights could result in as many as 5 million eligible voters not being able to register to vote in 2012. It also relates, again, to students who live part-time in one state and live the rest of the year in their home state, and they can also be affected. Why is this important? Because, as I mentioned earlier, we are looking at a very close election. We're looking at maybe a 5-point spread. So in certain states, if some people are disenfranchised or there's some dispute about whether they should vote or not, it can literally affect them being able to drive up, walk up, roll up, whatever, to their polling booths and to vote. Part of this going forward is going to probably rely on the federal government and Congress initiating and sponsoring a bill that will in some way guarantee the rights of those who should and who are eligible to vote. And with that said, Congressman Ellison, Keith Ellison from Minnesota, has introduced H.R., he's part of the House of Representatives, H.R. 3316, the Voter Access Protection Act of 2011. And this vital legislation would prohibit election officials from requiring individuals to provide photo identification as a condition of obtaining a casting or casting a ballot in an election for federal office or registering to vote in elections for federal office. So again, this specifically deals with the presidential election in 2012, the congressional election in 2012, since all 435 House of Representative members will be up for re-election. This particular bill would protect the vote based on where people live, who they are, and obviously what candidates they want to vote for. Well, it's encouraged that you make phone calls. I would encourage you to find out more about this, write letters, have a discussion within your community groups, within your groups in your neighborhood. You can certainly send faxes or emails. You can fax information to your secretary, your senators and your representative's office, your U.S. representative office. You can send an email or you can go to www.senate.gov. Senate.gov to find who your senator happens to be. And you can also go to House.gov and find out who your House of Representative is and follow that particular person's web page, contact them, and let them know how you feel. It's one thing to just think about voting. It's another thing to just think about, as we are looking at Black History Month, the sacrifices that were made in Selma, Alabama, in 1965, in March of 1965, Bloody Sunday is infamous now because of the brutality of those who were on the Edwin Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, just out there demonstrating and protesting and trying to secure the right to vote. And later that year, in 1965, we did get the Voters' Right Act. It's not an amendment. It is an act, and it has to be renewed, but it nonetheless is a form of protection. A particular bill that I had talked about that Keith Ellison has introduced would be further protection, H.R. 3316. So this is a local issue, this is a state issue, this is a national issue, but again, the concern that many of us have is that some voters are going to be disenfranchised based on the laws that are on the books that require extra documentation or extra proof that individuals are who they say they are. I'm not necessarily opposed to that. I am opposed to the way it is being used to disenfranchise some of the voters. So again, talk to your local, state, federal employees and leaders, congressional leaders. Let them know how you feel. And most importantly, get out to vote with the primaries that are going on right now, with the Republican primaries, with the election that will take place, the general election that will take place in November. Thanks so much for joining the show. I hope you have a great day, a great weekend. We'll be back next week with a very hot, important show. This is Carol Copeland Thomas. Have a great weekend. We will see you back next week.